The subject of immigration was already a hotly contested one in America, and that was even before President Trump laid out some executive orders on who gets into the country and who does not. The moves at the White House are getting plenty of attention, plenty of it from people who may be affected by them. Our next guest has lived in the United States since he was 9 years old and as yet does not have the benefit of citizenship. Ricardo Lujan is a senior at Southern Oregon University and was somewhat protected by immigration action by DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. Now there's a chance action will no longer be deferred. Ricardo Lujan, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I understand you grew up in Guanajuato, which is a sister city to Ashland. Were you aware growing up that there was a connection to Ashland?
Yeah, no, I actually did not know in Guanajuato that we had any connections with the United States.
Interesting. So what made your parents decide to leave Mexico and come to Southern California, I guess, initially?
Yeah, multiple circumstances, really. The main one being the economical hardship that we had as a family down there. My dad moved when I was 6 to the U.S. so he can provide for our family, and so I was separated from him for about 3 years until we actually moved to the U.S. as well once the hardship continued to grow and violence started getting involved as well. A lot of gang involvement started appearing within our area of where we lived, and my family just didn't want my sister and I to live in that kind of environment, grow up in that environment, and they wanted to be able to provide more options for us for our future.
Were you aware of the violence even as a 9-year-old?
You know, I grew up in that kind of environment, so to me, it didn't seem different. That's all I knew. But definitely, yeah, I mean, now that I look back, you didn't go a day without seeing police sirens going on. You didn't see a day where you didn't see a police officer get bribed so they wouldn't get charged with a crime. You know, it happens. But to me, as a 9-year-old, that was completely normal. That's all I knew.
So how big a culture shock was it for you as a 9-year-old? I mean, 9-year-olds obviously are a bit more adaptable than, say, 29 or 49-year-olds. But I mean, what was it like to try to make a transition, particularly in school? It sounds like you didn't have much English at all.
Yeah, not at all. The only words I knew when I moved to the U.S. was hello and goodbye. That was pretty much it. So school was actually very rough. I started the fourth grade in Southern California in a small town called Hesperia. And it was very difficult to adapt. I tried to assimilate as much as I could to my community. I lived in a very conservative part of town, and it became kind of like a survival instinct for me to assimilate to the community, because it was bad to be an immigrant. It was bad to be brown. It was bad to know a different language.
So that conservative in a white sense.
Completely. Yeah. Yes, completely. And to a certain extent, I tried to be as white as possible. I was ashamed of having an accent. I was ashamed of knowing a second language. I practiced as much as I could so I could get rid of my accent when I spoke English. Because if you had an accent, you would be looked at twice and not in a very nice way.
So you were really making efforts as a family, it sounds like, to stay below the radar.
Completely. Mm-hmm. Completely. And we saw it as a survival instinct for us.
Family of four, is that what you said?
Family of four. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And what did your father do, or how did your family bring in money?
Well, my father in California worked as a parking lot attendant for a bank in LA. My mom did not work. She actually went to school, graduated from high school, went to night school at Victorville. And my sister and I obviously were at work, but my dad was mainly the provider for our family.
So given you are aware of a certain level of tension and not wanting to appear to be Mexican in your community. So, I mean, were there ever moments when you were afraid that you'd been turned in or that you're going to be deported?
When I was that young?
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, there were times where I actually got injured at school and my mother would get called. Cause I would show up with, we were afraid to even show up to, a hospital or a clinic if I ever got injured. And I remember showing up to school with a wrap around my arm, and the teacher was asking me what happened, what's wrong, and I didn't know much English either, and I didn't know how to articulate what actually happened. So they ended up calling my mom, and they were like, why is your kid, why does he have a band in on his arm, what happened, did he go to the hospital? And so even the smallest things became a problem for all of us, and even driving down the street became a problem. You know, every time we saw a sheriff's patrol car drive by, we would be afraid to see what would happen.
That's quite a climate of tension to grow up in.
Completely. But we also grew up in an environment where we saw in a constant basis people being raided by ICE officers and getting deported for no other reason than being here undocumented.
And so was it just a stroke of luck that it never happened to you?
I believe so. And also the fact that, again, we tried so hard to assimilate to our community as well, to blend in. Growing up in that kind of environment, I really neglected a lot of my culture and a lot of my involvement with my community so that I wouldn't be tied in with them. And, you know, as a grown person now, I see how harmful that was to me and to my community, and that's why I'm getting more involved. But truly, yeah, growing up in that kind of environment, it really made you feel ashamed of being an immigrant.
So you've really kind of shoved the Mexican side aside.
Yeah, completely.
In your life.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your current status then?
Yeah, so right now I'm actually benefiting from the Deferred Action of Childhood Arrival, also known as DACA, which was an executive order that was signed on by President Obama in 2012. Now, with this program, you have to renew it every 2 years, and it doesn't give you any legal status. It only gives you legal presence. So technically speaking—
In other words, there's no green card or anything like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's no pathway to citizenship, to residency. It pretty much only says that, okay, the government knows that you're here undocumented, you're not a criminal, and you're not a violent person. Therefore, we are going to put you in the lowest priority of deportation, and while you're here, we're going to give you the ability to work. So we're going to give you a work permit.
All right. So at least you can do that much mm-hmm. legally. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ricardo Lujan, who is a senior at Southern Oregon University and a childhood arrival in the United States, been here since age 9. In Southern California, and we're talking to him about his own particular life story and about how that interfaces with the current situation in immigration in the United States. Your comments and questions are welcome on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So what concerns do you have about what might happen now, given what you've seen off of the desk of President Trump in his first 10 days?
Right. Yeah, well, there's a lot of concerns, not just by the executive orders that might be presented in regards to deferred action, but also the appointments that we're seeing take place. I mean, even the acting Homeland Security director right now is someone that in 2013 was very involved with ICE and was the director of, you know, departments that focus on deportation. We're seeing Senator Jeff Sessions being, discussed right now and appointed for Attorney General, which would make a huge impact into, you know, the definition of a criminal and expanding that range so that deportations may be more flexible. There's just a lot of things playing right now that are affecting the immigrant community, not just undocumented, but also legal residents as well and dual citizenship. We were seeing the executive order that banned Muslim countries, people from Muslim countries coming to the United States. Now, that didn't just affect visa holders. That affected lawfully permanent residents and dual citizens. So we're seeing that he's attacking every aspect of an immigrant, regardless of your status. And so that's very concerning to me, to the organization that I'm a volunteer of as well, which is Unite Oregon. And we're trying to respond as best as we can to these things.
You know, you mentioned dual citizenship. I was just reading this morning about a 5-year-old boy who has a dual American and Iranian citizenship mm-hmm. who had to spend many hours at the airport in L.A., I think it was L.A., mm-hmm. Being let back into the country that he is the only one he's really known.
Exactly, yeah. And we're seeing that those types of cases happening all around the country. What's been inspiring is that a lot of attorneys have been taking their time and providing pro bono services to these individuals. But the truth is, unless we stop all these executive orders through the court system, then they're just going to keep happening. And at the end of the day, it's up to us to pressure our Congress to make sure that they take action in these issues and get resolved.
So you mentioned that every 2 years you have to reapply for your DACA status. What's the next date coming up?
Well, it depends. It varies. Depending on when you applied.
For you in particular. I mean,
For me. Yeah. Well, yeah. Mine actually, you know, I have a limited amount of time left. I believe this year is my last year. So in a couple months, I'm going to be having to apply again.
What I'm getting at is I wonder how strategically you're thinking about when might be a good time
to a window
to make your presence known again.
Right, exactly. Well, there's a window in which you have to apply. You have to apply between 150 and 120 days from when it expires, before it expires. And so the way I look at it is that this program can be completely dissolved in a month. And it usually takes more than a month to get a renewal. At the end of the day, I don't want to take my chances in the fact that it might get dissolved. Therefore, I will be applying for it regardless if it goes through or not. My information is already there. The Department of Homeland Security has my information, so there's no...
They know who you are, they know where you are, essentially all that stuff.
Exactly. So the worst scenario that can happen in terms of applying for a renewal now would be that I would lose $495, which is what costs to reapply every 2 years. But I'd rather take that chance and possibly get renewed than to fear, you know, getting more unlawful presence for not having DACA in case the program still exists.
Okay, so you'll go ahead and risk the $495 and mm-hmm. and run the risk of them saying, you know what, we're gonna bring you in,
completely,
as opposed to trying to stay invisible and get hurt worse potentially later on.
Right. Well, one of the biggest fears that I have for my community is the fact that, you know, the only reason we were able to get DACA in the first place, the only reason we were able to have any kind of progressive movements in regards to immigration, was because we left those shadows. We came out of the shadows, share our stories, and put people that were not aware of this situation into our perspective. You know, they started looking at human beings rather than a political issue. If we go back into those shadows, we're going to completely take that power away from ourselves. So what I really want to do is, you know, by showing my face, by being vocal about my status and what I'm doing, I want to show my community that it's okay to keep fighting. It's okay to be out of the shadows, and this is not the time to back down. Right now is when we have to fight back, and it's up to us to really keep what we've worked so hard to obtain.
The people you've met through Unite Oregon and any other groups that you affiliate with, I mean, mm-hmm. I just wonder how typical your story is, you know, brought into the United States at age 9 because things weren't very good in Mexico.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not the only story out there. I'm a very vocal individual within our community, but I'm definitely not the only one that's experienced what you know, many immigrants experience.
And given the set of circumstances that are being talked about right now, you mentioned that you were the lowest priority for deportation, mm-hmm. but which is the same sort of thing that President Trump seems to be saying off to the side, that we're still talking about getting rid of criminal mm-hmm. aliens, but the definition of criminal could be expanded.
Exactly. Yes, and that's one of the biggest fears as well. Another thing is that we don't want to bank on the idea that President Trump has said that we're going to be the lowest priority. The truth is, we gave confidence to the federal government with our information. We applied. We gave them our address, our birthdays, everything. They know everything about us. And if President Trump uses that information against us to deport us, that breach of trust is going to be unprecedented, and it's something that we truly fear.
There's been such a flurry of activity in executive orders in the last, since the Trump administration started almost 2 weeks ago. I don't know if a lot of people noticed that there was also the discussion of potentially getting people out of the country if they have been using social services,
right?
If they're in any sort of welfare service. Have you heard about that as well?
Completely, yeah. And that's affecting, again, like I said, lawful permanent residents here in the United States. It's pretty much making it illegal to be an immigrant and poor. So if you're a beneficiary of any means-tested benefit and you have a green card and you're a lawful permanent resident, then you're facing risk of deportation by this regulation.
Ricardo Lujan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a senior at Southern Oregon University, a childhood arrival of the United States. If you want to talk about immigration with us, join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I noticed that you carried a sign recently that said undocumented, unafraid. Mm-hmm. Is the second one consistently true?
Yes and no. I think fear is natural, and it's obviously going to occur when extraordinary circumstances happen. However, I use that fear again to drive my activism and to really channel to my community and to let them know that, again, it might be a scary thing to do, but the only time we have power is when we're sharing our story. If I can change one person's mindset about why we're here in this country and how we're contributing to this community by sharing my story, then I'll do it 100% of the time.
And how do you respond to people who say, you know, you seem like a nice guy, you've done good things in the United States, you seem law-abiding, you know, you took care of all your paperwork under DACA and all that stuff, but the fact is that you're still here illegally,
right?
That you shouldn't have come to the country in the first place, whether or not you were in control of the decision at age 9. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to people who come at you from that point?
Well, you know, I'd love, again, to sit down with them and talk to them about why we came to this country in the first place. We hear a lot of talks about doing it the right way. Truth is, there's not a right way for many individuals unless you're fortunate enough to be born within a U.S. citizen's family, and that citizen being your immediate relative, then there really is no pathway towards you getting any kind of, pathway towards residency or citizenship. A petition takes up to 15 years for some countries, and some are more than that, some are less than that. But essentially, if you're facing fear or physical harm in your own country, you cannot wait that time to flee and get in a better state. I'd love to sit down with them, tell them my story, tell them why I do this. And at the end of the day, show them again, like, look, I'm your neighbor. I'm a regular person. I'm a student at Southern Oregon University. I pay my taxes. I'm an activist, and I volunteer and donate my time as much as I can to help others. I've seen myself as an American since I was 9 years old. No one's going to change that, and no paper's going to change that. I consider myself an Oregonian at the end of the day.
Are you going to graduate this June?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And what are you looking at for prospects beyond graduation?
Yeah, well, actually, I'm going to be taking one gap year, and then I'll be going to law school afterwards. And, my focus at SOU is actually business management with a certificate in nonprofit. And my end goal is actually to open up my own nonprofit law firm so I can help young refugees coming to the country and giving them legal representation.
So you've certainly made some plans, but in your darkest, most fearful moments, do you ever think in terms of like, well, if I have to go back to Mexico, here's where I'd go, here's what I'd do?
I'm not in that step yet, and I'll tell you why. I believe that, you know, I'm gonna do whatever I can to help my family, my community, and myself so that we can continue being in our home, which is the United States. And that's my end goal. That's my end plan.
All right, so no thought of anything south of the border.
That's not on my mind right now.
All right, Ricardo Lujan Valerio is a senior at Southern Oregon University, a childhood arrival in the United States, and trying to stay within the legal system as the system exists at the moment. Changes potentially coming. Ricardo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.